Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're coming to you from the margins of the Western Conservative Summit in Denver, Colorado, where I'm proud to be speaking Saturday. It's a very, very important conference of conservatives from across the region, really across the country, but it brings together some of the best people. And I'm always proud to be among them. The options for enhancing what, as is the title of the program, Western Strong, seem to me to be in need of attention as urgently as anything, because the country seems to be less and less strong in the West, for that matter, but also elsewhere. And this is a time for rebooting. And it's always a pleasure to be able to talk with one of the smartest guys I know on a whole host of issues about American strength and what is eroding it at the moment and the implications if it's allowed to continue on the trajectory we're on just now. His name is Robert Charles. He's no stranger to this audience. He is a former Assistant Secretary of State, among many other things, including a Congressional Counsel for the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses. He has also been a Naval Intelligence Officer and has served on Capitol Hill in senior oversight staff positions, as well as a clerk in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And Bobby, it is always good to have you with us, but particularly at a moment when the strength that our country needs seems to be sorely lacking, or at least under assault. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, always my pleasure, Frank.
I'd like to start with a particular line of attack that, as we've discussed in the past, is very troubling, I think, particularly to people like yourself who've had experience, in government, period, but specifically in the judicial branch. What we're witnessing at the moment with the latest indictment of Donald Trump and the prospect of still more being piled on in the near future is raising some very serious questions, both in its own right, in terms of jurisprudence, the pursuit of Donald Trump on charges of criminal misconduct involving classified information, and also whether there really is a double standard that is now unmistakable and incredibly corrosive. Talk us through all of that, if you would, sir.
Well, there's a lot there to unpack, Frank, but let me try to be efficient in the way that I do that. And I appreciate the opportunity. You know, you and I are both students of history, and the word unprecedented is used far too often because most things actually are precedented. This turn of events, first what's happening to a former president and what's occurring with the current president, are truly unprecedented events. And they have immediate sort of splash consequences, which will affect us, but they also have outward ripple effects that will affect the republic for decades, perhaps longer than that. And they're all adverse effects. So let me just quickly try to unpack them. You have a president of the United States for the first time not just indicted at the state and local level for things that really don't count for felonies, but now indicted at the federal level for the mishandling of federal documents under, one would imagine, they're trying to use it, the Espionage Act, but really what they're doing, there is no espionage. What they're doing is they're talking about mishandling pursuant to an administrative act, the Presidential Records Act, or if it were below president, it would be an administrative law, a different piece of administrative law. Typically, there are not criminal penalties for those things. So what we're looking at right now is the elevation of what are administrative mishandling of documents at best, which incidentally, the current sitting president also mishandled. And frankly, prior to 1980, as you know, Frank, prior to the Presidential Records Act, all presidents were able to and did take classified documents home, kept them in their presence. Why? Because they were writing from Lyndon Johnson to Jimmy Carter. They were writing memoirs and they were referring to these documents, as well as protecting themselves against a misunderstanding, by the public. But what's happened here is that you have allowed politics, we have allowed, the Justice Department has allowed politics to infiltrate the judicial process. And it is really quite damaging. The long-term effects are that you've now lowered the bar for future events. You are allowing what we think of as a corrupt practice around the world to infiltrate our government and to infiltrate the way we administer justice. Justice is supposed to be, remember, blind, balanced, right? It's supposed to not be political. Unfortunately, we have drifted in that direction. At the exact same time, almost as if you're tightening down the fine tuning on a microscope, you're seeing a really sharp contrast drawn with the current president, because the current president not only is facing the divulgement now from the Treasury Department of dozens and dozens of documents that indicate LLCs were set up by him or his family in order to funnel money from at least Ukraine, if not also China and Romania. But we now have a whistleblower who is crystal clear, viewed as credible by all parties, who the FBI wanted to cover up for and is still not producing a document the American people should see. But it indicates very clearly that Joe Biden and his son took a $5 million bribe from the Ukrainian government, which then triggered him taking action, going to Ukraine and threatening to fire the prosecutor who was going after his son's company, who had paid them the money, if that prosecutor was not fired. So, or to withhold, actually to withhold money from Ukraine if that prosecutor was not fired.
Foreign assistance, yeah.
Yeah. U.S. aid. So what you have is this unbelievable, it's gone from sort of a mild contrast to a very sharp A-frame contrast. And I think it's terrible for the Republic, Frank. As a matter of rule of law, we do not go after former presidents for mishandling of documents, and we do not permit sitting presidents to get away with federal crimes such as felony bribery.
Yeah. Let me just make a related point, if I can. Even if you just stick with the treatment of classified information, it would seem that Joe Biden has been engaged in practices that make whatever Donald Trump has been accused of pale by comparison in terms of mishandling unauthorized use of them as well. You have seen the indictment?
Yeah, I've read the description. Yeah, I've read the descriptions in the indictment. I think it's an 8-count indictment. And I actually read them with my other hat on, imagining that I was a clerk on a U.S. Court of Appeals and thinking, how does this look on appeal when the current president did many of the things that are articulated in this indictment? And, you know, you can talk about what's called scienter.
And has yet to be subjected to anything.
No, it has yet to even be brought up on anything. So, you know, I just think this double standard, to use your word, Frank, really frustrates Americans. And to your point and where you are right now, I will tell you that I read a data point yesterday that says that more Americans today identify as conservatives than at any time in our history back to Reagan. So maybe Americans are really fed up with all of this and they want accountability in their government. Because in the end of the day, a democracy without accountability is a tyranny.
Right. We had a very interesting and chilling conversation along these lines with Sam Faddis in yesterday's program, Bobby. And it, I have to say, it speaks to the point you've just made, that the American people are, I think, not only troubled by what they see here, this double standard, for want of a better term, the lack of equality under the law, equal justice under the law. But they're getting to the point where it's of sufficient concern about what it means, not just at the abstract level or even for the nation, but, you know, in their own lives as well, to a point that that I think is very, very dangerous indeed. We have to take a short break, Bobby. When we come back, I want to get your thoughts on, what might have happened had D-Day not gone as it did in the end. And how different the world might be had that alternative history played out, a subject that you have turned to recently in your capacity as a spokesman for the Association for Mature American Citizens. Come back to us right after this. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Freedom is an endangered species thanks to the Chinese Communist Party's so-called social credit system. It utilizes a comprehensive array of advanced surveillance, computing, and artificial intelligence technologies to monitor and control its own population. Worse yet, the Chinese Communists and their globalist allies at the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization, Big Pharma, and of course, the Biden administration, seek to impose this digital gulag here and throughout the world. The building blocks of that liberty-crushing project include Team Biden's bid to institutionalize the China model of pandemic lockdowns, emergency orders, and mandates, American businesses conforming to environment, social, and governance scoring, and the proliferation of global and national health IDs. The time to resist is now, while we still can. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. We're visiting with Robert Charles, a man who has had a role in helping govern our country in a number of different capacities, including one that he was, I think, drawing upon in the previous conversation about what's happening to the rule of law, namely the role that he played most recently as an assistant secretary of state, helping other nations do better jobs of having, well, equal justice under law, and how important it is really to a properly functioning civilized society. Bobby, I want to turn to a time when we were throwing everything we had at trying to assure that people who did not, among other things, practice equal justice under law, or for that matter, justice under law at all, namely the Nazis, defeated from their efforts to dominate not only Europe, but the world, namely a battle that took place, and we marked its 79th anniversary earlier this month, namely with the invasion of Normandy by our Allied forces on D-Day. You've written an interesting piece, I believe it was at amac.us, where I encourage people to follow your work and writings, exploring what might have happened had D-Day not gone as it did, not necessarily according to plan, because it didn't in every respect, of course, it never does in war, but
I'd be happy to.
It came out right, as far as we're concerned. Talk us through what might have been instead, yeah, and its importance for today as we think about what we have, what we may be in the process of losing in terms of what.
Yeah, so Frank, this is a great departure point, and important for us to remember things that it is very easy to forget. As I was writing a book called Eagles and Evergreens a few years ago, I spent a lot of time interviewing World War II vets and have stayed up with them as they have gradually diminished in number. One of them, toward the end of his life, we shared some tears listening to what he'd gone through, and he'd been at Anzio and up through the entire Italian campaign. But he said to me, there was nothing inevitable about either D-Day or the taking of Rome, which was the second of the third capitals, nor the end of the war. There was nothing inevitable about it. He said, the Germans fought hard and they could well have won. Normandy was the largest amphibious invasion in the history of the world, and probably ever to be, because now we have technology we didn't have then. We would have been detected. Just for an understanding, 1.5 million Americans were in Great Britain to support it. 257,000 boarded 7,000 ships. By the time they went ashore, more than 100,000 were landing from air and from sea. We lost 6,000 young boys that one day. By the time we got to Paris, we had 60,000 casualties. But the thing that people need to understand is that it was an act of extraordinary national courage and individual courage down to every last soldier. And what could have gone wrong were many, many things. And I attribute to divine intervention in some ways the outcome. Why? Because it was supposed to go off on June 5th. A meteorologist named Mr. Stagg went to Eisenhower and said, "It's, you know, they have no satellites. They had nothing to work with. It was pure intuition." But he said, "It's not worked. I don't think the 5th is the right day. I think we're going to have a massive storm on the 5th, and we could have a sequence of them. There will be a window on the 6th. And everybody else on Ike's staff said, "No, we can't replan this. It's all for the 5th. You know, inertia is a powerful thing." And Ike said, "Nope, I think he's right. We're going to go on the 6th. Well, the 5th would have been a complete disaster. And when Moon came out, the Moon came out 2 weeks later on the only other available day, and they probably would have been detected in between. That was a stormy disaster. So they got ashore by the grace of God on the 6th, even though there were tremendous losses under those cliffs. I have walked under those cliffs by myself, and I have walked among the crosses at the top. And I encourage every American, if you ever get the chance before the end of your days, to go do that. You will never think about it again the same. But, you know, we also used Higgins boats, and they were an invention by an American entrepreneur who went bankrupt creating them. He was trying to create a very, very shallow bottom boat for taking lumber, big wood out of the bayou. When he went bankrupt, he kept redesigning the boat until one day the United States government came to him and said, "We need an order of 20,000 tomorrow." And he said, "I will do it." And he did it. And the end game is that we would not have been able to take the Pacific Islands we took, nor would we have been able to win on D-Day were it not for the innovation of Americans. That's just one. But I do believe that God played, you know, George Washington said the hand of Providence played heavily into his victories, and I believe it played that day too, Frank. We need to prepare for tomorrow so that we don't have to have another D-Day.
Robert Charles, you just went exactly where I thought we need to now. We are witnessing an enemy that has emerged in the past several decades that makes, I believe, the combined forces of Germany, Italy, and Japan pale into insignificance. Not simply in terms of numbers of men under arms and military equipment and so on, but in terms of total comprehensive national power, as they like to say. The Chinese Communist Party is, of course, the threat I'm talking about. They even surpass the danger that we faced, I believe, at the height of the Cold War from the Soviet Union. And the prospect that you just talked about, that we may need to undertake military operations again, if not quite on that scale, but certainly on a very significant basis, unless we find the will and the capability to deter our time's existential threat to freedom from taking its apparently now chosen course of not waging simply unrestricted, pre-kinetic, if you will, violence against us, but a shooting war as well. Talk about, with that perspective of history that you just shared, both how vital it is that we rally to this moment and how best to do that as you see it, sir.
You know, I'll give you three basic points, Frank, and the third one is really the one you're looking for. But the meaning of D-Day, in really sharp contrast right now with how we are prepared to fight a war, I think leads to three things. Every American should grab a couple of memoirs from the D-Day, or not necessarily D-Day, but from World War II veterans, you know, E.B. Sledge's famous one from the Pacific, or go watch Band of Brothers, and understand the magnitude of commitment that was required to win, number one. Number two, I think we should apply forward the sacrifice. I do consciously think about some of these vets that we've lost. I sat down beside Colin Powell's grave site about 2 weeks ago and just thought for a while about what he did and what he learned. And he, of course, like we, had among us World War II vets. But the third one is we need to prepare as a nation. And as you rightly said, peace through strength is really Ronald Reagan's thinking, but it's frankly, it's a timeless principle. And that is that if we prepare for war, and what I really mean by that is if Democrats and Republicans all do not want a war with China that turns into a kinetic or shooting battle that is going to be devastating for both countries. We would win, but it would be devastating. It would be devastating. If we don't want that, then we need to do what Ronald Reagan did in ultimately reversing and rolling back the Soviet expansion and militarization. And that is, we need to be prepared to fight and to win. Not just prepared in the abstract, Frank, not just prepared in some random way, but every single service and tightly interconnected and educating the American people about why we're doing what we're doing in order to prevent war. We need to create the deterrence that stops the war that we don't want to have.
Amen. And we need to be, and we need to be about that right quick, because the hour is very late indeed. Bobby Charles, thank you again for your insights on so many of these fronts, and especially for helping put in perspective the challenges of our time, both here at home and from foreign adversaries as well. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Bradley Thayer, a great bit more about that China threat and what we need to do about it. Stay tuned.
To destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and I'm very pleased to say a special welcome to a personal friend as well as a very valued colleague at our Center for Security Policy. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. He is the director of the Center's China program, and I believe one of the country's foremost experts on the Chinese Communist Party, the threat that it poses to us today, and what we must do about it. He is the co-author of a very important book on the subject, of several actually, but the most recent of them is Understanding the China Threat. And he is a prodigiously productive contributor to the public policy debate through myriad outlets, including The Messenger and Epoch Times and The Hill and elsewhere, offering insights into, as I say, both the unrestricted warfare the Chinese have been waging against us, the people who have been helping them do it, and also what we must do now in light of the damage that's been inflicted upon us, mostly unknown to the vast majority of Americans, sadly. Brad is also, I want to say, a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and we appreciate so much his support for its work, including its webinars, to which he has contributed mightily. Brad Thayer, welcome to Securing America once again. It's always great to have you with us, sir.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to join you today.
I'm anxious to talk with you about a couple of things that you've been writing about, Brad, and it's good to have a little bit more time than usual to do so. You've written, as I said, a very important new book about understanding the China threat. And before we get to the deplorable failure to do that on the part of the US government and the intelligence community, most especially over successive presidencies, let's characterize, level set, if you will, on that threat. How would you characterize it without, you know, the blinders that some have had on for so long?
The threat is an existential threat to the United States and to Western civilization. The Chinese Communist Party seeks to destroy the United States, the alliance structure that the United States created, and the international order that the British and the Americans created after World War II, and the U.S. sustained after the end of the Cold War. So the threat is indeed, and it's not an exaggeration, it's not hyperbolic to say that it is existential. The Chinese seek to remake international politics. They seek to remake American society. They seek to destroy American power and turn the United States into a supplicant, to defeat it and to turn it into a supplicant. To that, they're, as you well know, Frank, and as have documented so many times, they're moving on all azimuths. They're moving diplomatically. They're moving in terms of their economic interests. They're moving in terms of political warfare directed against the United States. So they're moving in the military realm as well, as we're witnessing the tremendous growth of their nuclear power, the tremendous, that is, their nuclear weapons capabilities, the tremendous growth of their cyber and conventional capabilities, abilities in space that we see. Importantly as well, the CCP is claiming that it is justifiable in dominating international politics, setting the rules of the road for the 21st century. So everything that Americans have come to know and that our allies have come to know and the fruits of Western civilization that we enjoy are targeted by the CCP, and they seek to nullify every element of that and replace it with a tyranny. So thus, the dispositive question, as I often say, of the 21st century is whether freedom remains viable, it remains a force in international politics, or it's crushed by tyranny. In this instance, not the tyranny of the Soviet Union or of Nazism or Japanese militarism or Italian fascism, but of the tyranny of the Chinese Communist Party. So that's what's at stake.
We were talking briefly with Robert Charles in the segment before this one about comparing the threat we faced in just the way you have done, Brad, between enemies of old and those of today, and how much greater this one is by far, really, including, you know, the Soviets as well as the Axis of World War II. And yet, as you've pointed out, the United States intelligence community was largely caught flat-footed in raising appropriate warnings about what was coming. One of your co-authors in a series of articles now is Captain James Fennell, frequent guest on this program. And as you guys have pointed out, he, from his own background in intelligence, you from your close monitoring of it, including inside the Pentagon at the Office of National Office of Net Assessment, have really documented that this is something that was developing. It was perfectly obvious to people like Jim Fennell and you that it was developing, and yet it has only been until now, basically, if indeed fully now, that the intelligence community of the United States has really perceived what a tremendous existential threat we do face from the Chinese Communist Party. How could that possibly have happened?
Well, Frank, that's a fundamental question. The job of the intelligence community is to identify threats to the United States and to help formulate responses to those threats for the highest levels of the American government, the president and the interagency National Security Council. So how did this happen? It occurred in plain sight. China rose year after year, became more powerful year after year. And you can simply illuminate that with whatever data you're using, economic power, military power, or diplomatic force, or their political warfare capabilities. So we've witnessed this occurring again in plain sight. The intelligence community missed it. Why did they miss it? Well, it's a complicated question, but it ties into something, Frank, which you have also identified, coming at it really with a different azimuth. But first, it was Deng Xiaoping's strategic genius. It was his recognition that he could avoid American pressure, regime change, that is, American pressure to overthrow the Chinese Communist Party, by making partnerships with Wall Street, with American business interests. And so what existed as a trickle, some limited defense cooperation in the Reagan years and in the Bush years, turned into a torrent during the Clinton years. So Deng Xiaoping is a key part of why this happened. Secondly, it was
saying that American financial mavens and other business leaders, among others, by the way, were brought into a partnership with the Chinese Communist Party with the active assent and support of our government. Is that not the case? So
indeed,
the strategy's genius was not just that they found ways to suborn these elites, capture these elites, as they like to say, but they actually had the U.S. government fully on board with the whole effort.
Indeed. Deng recognized that he could play to a capitalist vulnerability, and that would be profit maximization and using labor in China. But it takes two to have a partnership, at least two to have a partnership. So he needed Wall Street to come on board, and Wall Street was more than willing to do so. South Korean, Japanese firms, to a large degree, were in the vanguard, but U.S. industry was in lockstep and followed very closely to become that torrent which I referenced. The Clinton administration really had a significant failure when the Clinton administration abandoned linking most favored nation trade status, which, Frank, as you remember, in 93-94, was linked to China's human rights record and could be linked to political reform in China. Well, the Clinton administration in 94 abandoned that, so that after 94, it was Katie bar the door. I mean, that there was there were not going to be any.
I have to interrupt you. I apologize. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more with Brett there right after this. I apologize. I'm wrong about that. You've got time. Just keep going, Brett.
So the Clinton administration, by ending that most favored nation trade status linkage and allowing it to be renewed in perpetuity without any reference to human rights or political reform, ensured that U.S. business would move very rapidly and very extensively into China. And of course, the profits of that were shared with many in Wall Street, in so many other firms, Frank, as you well know, and with political leadership. And that generated the problem of elite capture, where the wealth that was generated was not spread evenly. It was spread to, obviously, the architects of that and to the political leadership and the political components that made that possible.
Even more worrying was the fact that the profits were one thing. The money that was being transferred, by some estimates, Brad, I've seen between $3 and $6 trillion, was essentially found money that enabled the Chinese Communist Party to wage this unrestricted warfare against us, among many other things, and build military capabilities to give them the option for a shooting war as well. And again, just back to the question, the intelligence community of the United States seemingly was caught up, I guess, in this idea that these guys were all our friends and our partners, and nothing to see here, not to worry. Brad, we got to take a break. We'll be right back with more from Dr. Bradley Thayer of the Center for Security Policy on what all of this means for you right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Times of London reports that U.S. State Department has concluded at last that a Chinese Communist biological warfare laboratory in Wuhan secretly genetically modified a bat coronavirus to make it more transmissible and lethal to humans. This is not exactly news. In fact, it has been obvious for years, but the evidence contradicted the officially approved narrative derived from the Chinese Communist Party's lies, then legitimated and amplified by the World Health Organization it controls. Consequently, we must address the reality that once the virus was out of the Wuhan lab, it was deliberately spread to this country and globally by the CCP in what amounts to a deliberate biological warfare attack. The Chinese Communist Party is a transnational criminal organization that must be prosecuted and punished for this and other war crimes against innocent people. Ditto, its accomplice, the WHO. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We are speaking with Dr. Bradley Thayer, my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, the co-author of Understanding the China Threat. And we've been talking about why it is that the U.S. intelligence community has not so much understood the China threat, at least until very recently. And Brad, I think you've made the case pretty persuasively that our political elites, our business elites, we could throw in academia, media, Hollywood as well, have been essentially blinded to the true nature of the China threat. It's still a little unclear to me why the intelligence community would have fallen under the same misapprehension that a richer China would be good for us as well.
Indeed, as they shouldn't have, Frank. I mean, it leaves us all scratching our heads. The job is to identify threats, and yet a threat is growing year after year. Part of the answer to that question is Deng Xiaoping's hiding and biting, and that was to minimize the threat that China was at least as China was perceived by the outside world. But it was also, again, that elite capture was so pernicious because that wealth flowed into think tanks. That wealth flowed on the Hill, it flowed in obviously for political campaigns, and it flowed into think tanks. And thus, think tanks also conducted their own independent analysis of China, of the threat from the PRC, and they had a vested interest in minimizing the threat from China, because China, their think tank, was being funded in part by Chinese money. So that discussion, that dialogue, the critical questions that should have been asked about, is it in America's interest to allow the rise of such an odious government that that will become essentially a peer and maybe even more powerful than the United States? Think tanks were producing material that was incorporated into the intelligence community, that was providing assumptions, for example, on the analysis that was being conducted by the intelligence community. So now you can begin to see that there has been a circle. The wealth that was generated essentially bought an interest in China's continued growth.
Yeah. And Brad, we both worked at that think tank. You've been associated with a number of them over the years. But the bottom line is this. I mean, we are endlessly told about the omniscience of our intelligence community. You know, I can read license plates from space is one of the famous shorthands for it. And yet they seemingly missed the accumulation of what the Chinese call comprehensive national power, a favorite example of which is one of their shipyards is larger than all of ours put together, as an example of kind of industrial power that was built up over many years, of course. But were there not people in the intelligence community who we're just monitoring that sort of thing, that we're counting the number of missile silos or the counting the number of ships being put to sea or that sort of thing, that without the blinders of the captured elite in the political space or in think tanks or elsewhere, would just be coming up with, you know, what you used to do, that assessment that suggested this was going in the wrong direction and would become very perilous indeed.
Indeed, Frank, and as you know, there were a few like Andy Marshall and others, Mike Pillsbury, who were warning about this from day one, but it was easy to discount their warnings because, as you said, China was growing, silos, capabilities were growing, but facts don't speak for themselves. Facts have to be placed in a theoretical context of an explanation, and facts are rooted in assumptions. And the assumptions of too many, absent Andy Marshall, Mike Pillsbury, and others, was that China's not a threat. They're simply doing this as great powers might have done, but they're not aggressive. And again, it was hide and bide. It was Deng Xiaoping's genius not to provoke essentially a reaction.
That mask has slipped under Xi Jinping, as you've documented so well, Brad, and throughout, I think, this period. You were
among those,
of course, who was warning of what was actually afoot. But it brings us to the present moment when we are now really, I think, on notice that this threat is real and is at our throats. And the question is, are we behaving in a manner that is likely to intensify that danger, if not actually conduce to a shooting war with these guys? Or are we, in fact, now behaving, you know, like the formidable power that is needed at the moment to deter further thought of aggression, let alone acting upon it by Xi and others?
Well, Frank, as you know, the PRC has grown so powerful that it's impossible now to ignore, and it is so forceful in advancing its interests, which are inimical to U.S. interests, that the issue is on the table. However, I'm not sure that the rudder has turned. Certainly, the Trump administration did its level best to do so, but with the Biden administration, we are seeing at best an ambivalence towards the China threat, and at worst embracing the elements of the CCP due to elite capture problems, which you've identified in the indictment, your new book, and which need to be certainly addressed. The Biden administration is weak on China. They're weak on China because they don't perceive the threat to the extent which is obvious to so many. And the intelligence community, of course, provides products that they know the administration wants to read, that reflect the administration, that mirror what the administration. So what we're going to see from the IC is more of the engagement school. And that is that Xi Jinping may be bad.
Intelligence, in other words, not objective analysis of the facts. Yeah. Brad, indeed, we have to take a short break. When we come back, we will talk further about what that, well, I think of it as capture of the government of the United States by the Chinese Communist Party is translating into in terms of intensifying the danger we're facing and what we have to do about that. We'll be visiting with Brad Thayer about that and more on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned.
We're back, and we're finishing up our conversation with Dr. Bradley Thayer of the Center for Security Policy, in which we've been talking about How is it that our intelligence community and really the government of the United States more broadly has for so long misunderstood the nature of the Chinese threat? And, well, whether the Biden administration and its intelligence apparatus is doing any better with it. Brad, you were talking a bit about how unmistakable it now is that the Chinese Communist Party is the greatest existential threat to freedom of all time. And yet the administration seems determined to promote this idea that if only we can just get back into some kind of regular dialogues with the CCP at senior levels, that we'll, you know, again, have the ability to engage, as they like to say, with them without fear that things might go seriously wrong. What are your thoughts about how we are conducting this this critical moment, and in particular, the delusion that, as Winston Churchill used to say, jaw-jaw is better than war-war, but it may actually conduce the way we're proceeding with exactly the latter, a shooting war, specifically.
Frank, that's a critically important issue now with the Biden administration's policies, as you observed. I think the fundamental problem here is that you can't go back again. The CCP's aggression is now in evidence because it has the power to advance its aggression in a way that it didn't subsequently. That's why Deng Xiaoping had hide and body as a strategy. Now Xi Jinping is the reverse of that, right? He's as loud as can be in terms of advancing his interests. The Biden administration is weak on China. It's weak on China for reasons that quite clearly lead to the president of the United States and the problems that he has, but also a deeper problem that so many in the Democratic Party and some in the Republican Party are influenced by Chinese cash, as they were by since the Clinton years, yes. When this problem reached the highest levels of US politics. So we face this problem with a leader who's being funded to some degree and has had a very close relationship with so many Chinese entities, as Wall Street has, as Silicon Valley have, as so many in our elites have. So it's a terribly difficult problem. When the elites are weak on the threat, it's very hard for those working within the intelligence community to speak truth to power in this instance and to say again that this is China is an existential threat, because that's not going to be good for their careers.
Yeah. That's, you know, I just have to say that it's particularly concerning in that regard that Bill Burns, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, or arguably our premier intelligence element, is a guy with a track record of being himself involved in Chinese influence operations, and I believe being captured and having lied about it to the Senate Intelligence Committee when he was up for his confirmation to that post at CIA. I mean, this is a mortal peril, it seems to me. And it's compounded by the interest that the Biden team has expressed and is, well, manifesting every day, I think, in a particularly problematic line of attack of the Chinese Communist Party's unrestricted warfare, Brad, and that is its use of international organizations to advance what it calls global governance, an arrangement that's, you know, one world government by any other name, with the Chinese clearly envisioning themselves being at the helm. Talk a little bit about this in the context of the World Health Organization and what the administration is doing to really, you know, crater our sovereignty and make us all the more likely, perhaps without even fighting, to be subordinated to and ultimately, as you put it earlier, destroyed by the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, it's clear the Biden administration is supportive of the WHO's aims. And it's one of the first acts of the Biden administration, Frank, as you'll recall, was to go back into the WHO after Trump had left that international institution. The WHO is conducting the attack on sovereignty and on individual freedoms and liberties. And it's not a coincidence that the Biden administration is supporting it, just as they promote the open southern border as an attack on sovereignty, as they promote essentially cooperation and engagement with the CCP, also an attack on sovereignty of the United States. It would have been unthinkable in previous generations, but nonetheless, here we are. So too through the world international organizations like the UN, like reiterating essentially the Paris climate agreement, which again, Trump had left. Biden brought the United States back into it, even though it is heavily weighted towards China, and it is only it's a fetter on American industry, on American energy production, and American way of life, American liberties, yes. And American birthright. So this is another datum point, Frank, that we're witnessing. The attack on sovereignty is all absence as conducted by the Biden administration. And it's incumbent upon the Senate, our elected representatives, and the American people to be cognizant of that and hold them to account for those violations.
We are not doing it at the moment, that's for sure. And I think it's partly, as you've said, Brad, a function of the lingering misapprehensions. It's certainly a function of the elite capture. But at the end of the day, what really worries me is it seems to be fitting kind of the larger profile of, well, a wrecking operation against our country on the part of the Biden administration. And sovereignty is at both the national and at the personal level, one of those things that's central to our constitutional republic. And if it is, essentially surrendered to a proxy for the Chinese communists, we will rue the day for sure. And it makes all the more urgent the call that you've given so clearly here and elsewhere for us to understand the China threat and to respond appropriately to it. We have to leave it at that for the moment. Brad Thayer, thank you for the work you do at the Center for Security Policy. Come back to us with more as soon as possible. And I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Until then, go forth and multiply.